We're going to talk a little bit about the Housing Accelerator Fund because we've sort of taken it for granted as like this thing that's going on and everyone's probably familiar with, but that may not be the case.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to get your thoughts on which little ones could be the next wave to ride, because one of the things you and I have talked a lot about is how the existing model, and let's like be totally transparent about it, was buy dilapidated undermarket stock, vacate the properties and renovate them, get them to market rent and repeat. Mm-hmm. That model is sort of non-existent.
If you're a real estate investor, it's extremely important because there is land values are changing fast. Property values are changing. Opportunities are available again. This old thing that everyone's saying, there's no opportunities and what you can't replicate and can't make money. This is like a whole new addition, a center plan that you can make money on. And I think there's also something to be seen from what they're doing to prepare for the future to, again, have some big windfalls if that's what you're looking to do. When I was broke, I had rich habits. When I was broke, I
had rich habits. All right.
We're back.
And is this going to be our first video that we're going to have fully functioning audio and fully functioning video?
It was until you jinxed it.
Yeah, until the video crashes here halfway through.
We're sucking a lot of power out of this room right now with all these lights and cameras and everything. But yes, fingers crossed. I finally learned how to do this. I think it's sorted. We have power cords going into the cameras, the right size memory cards. Everything's wired for sound.
Good. I think the sound was overall pretty good. We had a little mishap on episode 3.
Yep.
And some video problems as well.
We just turned around and they're both dead.
For those of you who...
Listen to that episode.
Anyone who's consuming the podcast still and finding some stuff lacking a little bit, we are getting it sorted out. And for those of you who haven't been able to see an episode or listen to an episode because you listen and watch on YouTube, even our past episodes that we didn't have video, we are going to get them uploaded just as audio onto YouTube. So I promise those will be up there soon. And perfect smooth sailing from here on out.
Yeah. Welcome back to Master Keys.
Yes.
Season 3, episode 4.
Yeah. We're going to talk a lot about the Jana Halberton.
And what are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk a little bit about the Housing Accelerator Fund because I think we've talked around it just peripherally and we've sort of taken it for granted as like this thing that's going on and everyone's probably familiar with, but that may not be the case. It's also informing a lot of the things we're going to talk about.
If you're a real estate investor, it's extremely important because there is land values are changing fast. Property values are changing super fast. Opportunities are available again. This old thing that everyone's saying, there's no opportunities and what you can't replicate and can't make money. I think that this is, again, another... It's same as when Center Plan came out and there was a ton of opportunity then. This is like a whole new addition, a Center Plan that you can make money on. And I think there's also something to be seen from what they're doing to prepare for the future to, again, have some big windfalls if that's what you're looking to do.
Yeah, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on which little ones could be the next wave to ride, because one of the things you and I have talked a lot about is how the existing model, and let's like be totally transparent about it, was buy dilapidated undermarket stock, vacate the properties in most cases, renovate them, get them to market rent and repeat. Mm-hmm. That model is sort of non-existent anymore. It's dead. Is that dead?
Yeah, that's dead.
Are we confirming time of death for that model?
Time of death has taken place. It's in the obituaries. It's gone.
Which was sort of...
I get it. And
that was their intent.
And I think they did a great job of killing it. They did a great job in ending its life. So yeah, no, that's good. We'll get into that in a little bit. And I guess, well, maybe we can start with that even. So I have a couple news articles, but we'll start with that of like, they are changing the rules extremely fast on so many things.
No, the rules are changed. I mean...
Well, no, but there's regarding that, but then it's like there's new tax laws that seem to change every single day.
Yeah.
Immigration laws change every single day. And rent rules seem to even be changing every day where there's new Bill of Rights or something that they want to put in. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to go through, but they are proposing a ton of things. So maybe we start with capital gains because I feel like that's the hottest topic that everyone has heard about and is freaking out about. They're taking what is now currently they tax 50% of a capital gain to 67% of a capital gain for corporations or for personal if it's over $250,000, not including your primary residence.
Yeah. And I think we take for granted a little bit that people know what capital gains is. So just
true enough. Let's back up.
So essentially capital gains are the returns that you make or the profits that you make on an asset that when it comes to real estate is not your primary residence. So we know that when you buy and sell your primary residence, you get that money and that just comes to you and it's...
For now.
You know, for now it's tax-free, if you will, mm-hmm. because it's your primary residence. If you own a property that's not your primary residence, it's considered an asset. And when you sell that, the profit that you make from what you paid for it and what you sell it for, you effectively are going to be taxed on 50% of that profit. So if you bought something for $200,000 and then down the road you sell it for $400,000, you're going to be taxed on 50% of the $200,000 profit, $100,000, obviously. And that essentially would get added to your income for that year and you'd be taxed accordingly. So most times that pushes you, that sale pushes you into a pretty high tax bracket, as you can imagine. So if you made a $200,000 profit, you're taxed on $100,000 of that. It moves you into a bracket where you might be paying taxes of 40-odd%. So it's reasonable to think you might pay around $40,000 in capital gains tax on that $200,000 profit on the sale of that asset.
The easy and safe, that makes sense. The easy and safe math is just say 25% is what the tax works out to in capital gains. Because you say it's, you bump to the highest tax bracket.
50%.
Say 50%. And because it's on half of the gain, it's a half of that. So it's 25% is the effective. So to what Jalen said, if you made 200 grand, depending on what province you're in, you're between 40 to 50K on your taxable.
Yeah. And of course, when you sell, so if you are liquidating one of your rental properties, remember that a couple of things you're going to expense are all your realtor fees, any work that you have to do to get the property ready for sale. It would make more sense to kind of write that down as a capital investment rather than an expenditure. So to kind of get that
everything
profit,
you can
quote,
do
unquote,
to try and get your profit down.
The other thing to bear in mind is people are like, well, you know, I didn't actually make that $200,000 profit because over the years I did this, I added decks, I did the windows and blah, blah, blah. It's like, yes, but how did you record those for tax purposes? If you recorded those as a capital investment over the years, then that would have raised your base, right? So if you bought it for 200 and you made capital improvements of $40,000, then your profit that you'll be charged on would only be against an initial outlay of investment of $240,000. But most of us, what we do is we expense those things annually to keep our annual income tax down. So when you add those new windows, chances are your accountant or you personally have been expensing those. And if you've already expensed them in the past, you can't now claim them as a capital investment. The other thing that people do is they often depreciate their rental properties because, like, oh man, I'm making too much money. You know, I don't want to pay tax on this, and so they go,
"You have to depreciate to be able to float it, unless you want to dump money in every year."
Yeah. So what that means is, technically, once something's an asset, it can depreciate, even though we know real estate goes up. The idea is sort of that the land is what's going up; the building on it is an asset that depreciates because it's a physical thing. So you can depreciate that asset and then claim that as an expense against your earnings. The problem is when you do that, say you bought something for $200,000, if over the years you depreciated it for tax purposes down to 100, now when you sell it for 400,
you also have to look back on that.
Yeah, you pay tax on not only your gain from your purchase price, but also your recovered depreciation. So all of really important things to understand if you think, because I think a lot of people right now are kind of like, man, I'm getting a little tight. I'm going to liquidate one of these rental properties that's not that exciting. I talked about this where I liquidated one. I think were we still recording when I sold that one?
Right around the end of it.
Yeah. Where I was like, you know what? I'm looking at what I'm going to have to put into that property over the next little while. I'm looking at some other debt that I'm carrying and why it would make sense to take that equity and then, you know, put it somewhere else.
So,
but I had a big capital gains expense on the sale of that property.
All to say, this is why a lot of people don't sell, is because the tax liability ends up making it way more oftentimes makes it more beneficial to just refinance it.
Yeah.
It really swings it in that favor. And so that's why a lot of people don't sell. These tax laws ultimately do push up prices because then people are like, I'm only going to sell it if I get X dollar. But now what have they changed? So they've now increased that from 50% to 67% of what the amount that's going to be considered as taxable. But right when you walked in here, you said the devil's in the details because it hasn't gone through yet, but there's talk that they're going to only tax at the 67% effective amount
for
gains made after the date June 25th, 2024.
Exactly. So
technically, if you sell July 5th, you are really not going to pay the 67% because you're going to have made maybe $30 in those 5 days.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And again, we'll see how this all plays out.
Don't quote us on anything. Yeah.
Either way, you're going to be taxed on 50% of it. The question is, will you be taxed on 67% of the total amount that you've gained over the last 10 years?
As if accounting wasn't complicated enough.
Yeah. Or can you say, like, all right, this is what it's worth on June 25th. And then any gain I realize above that in the future, whether you sell on, like you said, July 5th, or if you sell 2 years after, those gains from June 25th of 2024 onward, 67% of those would be taxed. So not sure. Either way, it's not good. Like, you're going to be paying more tax if you are liquidating one of your assets. And people not surprisingly, are pissed off about this, because one of the things is it is becoming mainstream or widely known that Canada is having a massive productivity problem, which means that our labor is not producing as much per capita compared to our peer countries out there. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One, we're bringing in a lot of people that are essentially either students or retail workers, and that's lowering our productivity per capita. So some of it is skewed data. But the other thing
I don't know that they're retail workers. I think that's the only job that they can get.
Fine. Yeah, yeah, sir. That is the job.
I would say there's
that's semantics.
Okay.
I'm not saying they're coming here as like, I am a retail worker.
Okay, I was going to say, they're not applying like, I am the Gap All-Star.
Skills,
overseas.
I can fold a beautiful hoodie.
Yeah, they're usually like, I'm a doctor, but you guys won't recognize any of my shit here, so now I work at Gap.
Correct.
Okay, Gap. Continue.
Is Gap still a thing? Gap was hot back in the day. Do you have a Gap hoodie or Gap fleece?
No.
No?
Actually, I did. That's a lie.
Yeah.
My mom definitely got me one.
Oh, yeah. So some of that's that, but also, and this is what people are saying right now, it disincentivizes you to grow past a certain point. And the tech sector is especially upset about this because you're around like tech startups more than I do. Yep. What's the big dream of a tech startup one day?
Well, you want to be a unicorn.
And then you do what with it?
Sell it.
You sell it.
You sell it to one of the bald guys or something that's got a bunch of money.
Yeah. So, and I know that sounds crazy or counterintuitive, but those things build with the idea of one day selling. And when you're like, I can't even sell it to make it a whole lot worthwhile.
I mean, if you're building a unicorn, though, you're probably not licensing it in Canada or the States. There's probably a really nice island somewhere off the coast.
But still, even for smaller scale things.
I know.
Right? Like, this is what you're trying to do.
Yeah, there's only so much you can shelter.
Yeah. And so it just gets less, you're less incentivized to really expand your businesses. Like, you really are.
And there's a million other businesses in medium-sized sectors, industrial, and just support businesses that'll be worth tens, 20s, 30, $100 million that aren't going to go through the trouble or aren't interested in doing offshore accounts that are going to, like you said, way less incentivized to want to do business here or grow their business. And like, it just continues to make people be like, why the hell am I doing this if I'm giving it all away?
Yeah. Because when you start, like, imagine a scenario where someone builds a really successful small scale business. And I don't even know if we need to be specific to an industry, but if they one day get a valuation on their business of like $1 million, I mean, you're looking at businesses right now, like smaller businesses.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think, like, a small to medium sized local business only, what do you think most of them are worth? Like, what would they trade for?
Probably between $1 million to $2 million.
Okay. So $1 million to $2 million.
Excluding restaurants, because Nobody wants to buy those.
But say $1 million to $2 million.
Yeah.
That's what they're worth. Presumably, would you do that usually as a share sale? So you'd then take on some liabilities with that?
Usually, yeah.
Okay. So what that means, when you buy a business, you often buy the shares because you're not doing an asset sale like real estate. So you buy the shares of the company. And with that, you assume any liabilities that they would have. But neither here nor there. Say that person has built that business out over how many years?
Probably 10.
10 years.
I say 10's minimum.
So let's split the difference and say it's a $1.5 million business that they built over 10 years. That means if they sold it and they got to keep every single dollar, they would make $150,000 for every year they put into it before tax.
Yeah.
Right?
But then they're losing 33% of that to government. I don't know that they're going to... I'm just thinking, as you're talking, I'm thinking about, if you, like how you said, that they will give you the current tax rate for anything made prior to...
Which I don't know. I know.
I know. Yeah. June 25th, 2024. I struggle with it a little bit because our entire economy is made up of real estate, and really this tax law is pointed at real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in real estate, you could very easily be like, I made all of my capital gains from 2019 to 2023. And you're probably gonna be able to say that for the next 5 years.
Touche, right? Like that is a valid point. But if they put this in...
But maybe they're planning for the future.
Exactly.
Maybe.
They're planning for the future. A lot of these expenditures, when you're talking about a budget, are like, over the next 10 years, we're going to do the following, right? The funny thing is, this reminds me of some of these ideas that governments roll out, and like, this is going to generate this much money as long as no one changes their behavior. But what do people do? They change their behavior.
Yeah.
So no one's going to sell.
Okay. Yeah. Well, two things. And this is, now you've convinced everyone I'm a socialist. Here's the two reasons why I think this
Comrade
is.
Comrade Neil.
Yeah. This is why.
I got to put that on a t-shirt and sell it.
This is why.
Comrade Neil.
This is why this is good. This is why it makes sense on there in a little bit. It is going to force a ton of deals to close in the next 2 months. I know it is. I'm seeing it now. There's even deals that I'm going to try and close now before that, because...
Good luck.
Well, it's tough. It's 10 weeks, so it's going to have to be hammered down. But there's a bunch of cash deals that'll close. I guarantee you it'll cause a blip. It's like Same with when CMHC changed the rules leading up to it. Like, people are still going to use CMHC.
Yeah.
But when there was an opportunity to save 0.5%, literally people went ballistic to get it in. And this is the same concept. And like, I'm doing a deal right now where they're going to save probably $1 million in tax. So they're going to come up with a way to close on time. Anyways, my point is they're going to bring in a ton of money really quickly into the government. Okay. Which is valuable for them. The second thing is, yes, it disincentivizes selling, which kind of makes sense because they want to incentivize construction. And so people are going to be less inclined to sell, or they're going to stop to sell for higher prices, which is then again going to force people to have to build, whether they own currently, because they're not going to want to buy from other people for their high prices, and they don't really want to sell their stock. And or for people trying to get into the marketplace, they're going to look more closely at actually building. So it actually makes sense on those fronts. Now, do I want to pay a higher tax rate? No. Do I think that is how to do it? And I think there's other incentives that could have been better? No. And I think I was chatting with an accounting person that we both use, and we had the same kind of point, which is it would have been really good if they said, okay, this is the rate if you're going to just extract the cash from everything. But if you reinvest it in something, maybe it doesn't go to zero like it does in the States, but it goes back to 33%. So it's like, okay, so if you're withdrawing the capital gain, it's 67%. But if you reinvest within 18 months into another project, the capital gain actually goes down to 33% effective.
Yeah.
Then it'd be like, oh, yeah, okay,
this is why
I'm saving 18% on this. If you make $1 million, okay, so I'm saving 200 grand to reinvest this money into something new. And you see in the States how successful that is.
Yeah, because units change hands and all these things.
Yeah. And if you could put it in other businesses too, that'd be really neat. Then you'd actually probably see some productivity growth, which they're all like, they're so concerned about, or at least that's what they talk about. Yeah. Anyways, the long and short of it, we're going to move on to the next thing because we can talk about tax forever and be unhappy about it. What do you got going on?
I'm just looking at the response to this has not been positive. Perhaps
the tax?
Yeah.
They didn't have that same feeling I did about.
No, I don't know that what that was their end game that you're talking about, where you're
saying, I don't
know,
like, that's their,
oh, they're going to do
like
this because this is going to spur on new construction. I think what you're presuming there is that people who want to go out and buy existing used stock when they can't are going to then go and build. I don't know who that person is that's like, I'm typically buying, you know, mid-century class B stock, but instead I'm just going to build new. I don't know. In fact, I see a lot of people who like to liquidate their existing B stock stuff in order to build new. Yeah. And now they may not be able to do that.
Yeah.
And then it makes it actually harder for them to build. So I don't know. I just think that you just can't tax people into obscurity. And this is another thing around this. Like, you and I are looking at this where we're trying to figure out what's the next adventure.
Yeah.
Right. And I've essentially kind of pressed pause on the notion of building anything.
Yeah.
Because it's just so darn expensive. And as well as I have done, like, I've done everything on my own, so I don't have cash backers and I'm not super interested in having them. And that's what I would need in order to build.
Yeah.
But the people who are able to build here are either second or third generation established and wealthy. And they have like this train just running full steam down the tracks and they can build. The other people that can build are people who just arrived here and they came here with a lot of money. Because they came from countries where they don't tax all your money away. So this is my little rant here. Like, if you are born and raised here and you don't start with a bit of a leg up,
you're screwed.
You are screwed in this country. Like, you can't actually go rags to riches in Canada in nearly the way that one would like to think.
It's a multi-generational process.
It's a multi-generational process.
It continues to get harder.
If we think that is still possible now, which I don't know that it is, because the transfer of wealth, they're going out of their way to make the transfer of wealth through generations much more difficult. So even that, I think, is going to be really hard to replicate what's happened maybe in the last two generations. But then we have this thing where we are happy to welcome people from other countries and all of their money, which I get and I like and it's awesome, but they come here with the amount of money that no Canadian can accumulate in their lifetime. And the reason being is, from the day we turn 16 years old, they tax us into almost within an inch of our life. We turn 16 in this country and they start taking from you. And in other countries, they just don't. And then those people make a bunch of money in these other countries and then come to Canada. And what's going to happen is, you know, another generation from now, all of the big projects in Canada are going to be owned by, once again, you know, second generation people, which is great for them, but it is kind of a bummer. Someone who just like grew up here and doesn't have that opportunity.
I agree to an extent. There's a couple of things that I want to add in there. I don't think that everyone that comes over here has a ton of money.
No, not at all. No, I'm saying the people doing these projects.
Okay. I would say, and I think that you'll see people that are first generation that have immigrated here that'll end up doing projects. And I think it's like the type of people that are willing to uproot themselves and move across the world, come here with a grind and a hustle, and their entire life is riding on a certain level of success. Yep. And they will grind out so hard to make that thing come to fruition. Not discredit the people that are here and not saying that they're not working hard. And then I totally agree with you.
But at the end of the day, you need multiple millions of dollars. And not many Canadians can start with nothing anymore and accumulate that. Because as soon as you do here, they come for it all.
I agree.
They come for it all.
I agree. I'm just not of the mindset of like, well, because to me, that rhetoric, when you hear that, then it just kind of re-solidifies the mindset of like, yeah, like this is another person just telling me like I couldn't do it. So why would I even bother? Right. So that's why I'm like, I agree with you. I agree with you.
You just don't want to say it out loud.
Well, no, I don't want it. I don't want like the mindset. I don't want people's mindset to be of that where it's like, I'm not gonna be able to succeed now because look at what this country's done. Do you know what I mean?
I know. I guess. And maybe I'm just feeling beat up about it, but like it is exhausting in this country to work all this time.
I had a meeting this morning with someone who lived in different parts of the world, in Europe and the States. And they're like, yeah, this being in Canada is the hardest. Like she's like, here, I feel like I'm working to live. Feel like I'm working to live. And she's doing very well. But she's like, I am working to live here. She's like, when I was in the States, it's a totally different mindset. Like you actually enjoy your life there. And if you work really hard, you're working to be like above average or have some really exceptional thing, but you're actually there focusing on what you want to enjoy and being able to excel. And I think I've told the stories on here before, people that I know that have moved to the States without changing jobs or income, but from in Canada, they were negative every month and their parents were having to supplement them. And they're working to live and they lived a pretty man life. They go to the States and now they're able to put cash in the bank every month because the buying power of the dollar is 35% higher. A bunch of things are less expensive. Like there's, you know what I mean? And they're not taxed to the absolute hilt. Yep. So at the end of it all, they're taking home 50% more money. Additionally, rents are lower. Like there's so many main gas is cheaper. The car payment was cheaper. So she's like all the main items in her life came down by 20%, 30%.
Yeah.
So I agree with you totally. Just like I just don't want, I'm like, I mean, I'm the one that talks about leaving all the time.
Defeatist.
Yeah. I don't want to sound defeatist because I just hate the mindset of like, here they are, they're screwing us again. Like, I'm not even going to bother with this shit. And like, but I do feel that. I feel that constantly. Hence why I talk about leaving all the time, like relentlessly.
Yeah. I'm just at this point where like I have worked nonstop for 15 years to try to get to a point of like building something that might be able to set my family up for a couple generations, right? And to still feel like I'm still grinding and still not there. And even when I look forward to like, okay, and then maybe I'll be able to sell some stuff and cash that out and all that. It's like, no, they're going to get you there too, right? Like already, you know, I've been really fortunate to have made more than I would have ever thought possible.
All right, let's move this whole thing to Miami.
Like if I was in Miami, bro.
I was looking at boats today in Miami for rent. That's not that expensive. There's a lot of them there.
I'm going to Miami basically the week that this airs. Chandler, Miami? I might have to zoom in.
I
will zoom in. I'll figure out a way to do an episode.
Completely caked in sunscreen, still burnt.
I'm about to invent a new SPF. Like, you don't even know. I might be the first three-digit SPF.
Melting. We may never see you again.
Do they have three-digit SPF yet? Is there a SPF 100?
I have no idea, but that's...
I mean to find out.
All right, let's change the topic. No more depressive stuff. Let's just throw some casual headlines out here. Actually, I have more depressing headlines. That's all that catches my eye. Okay. So I was originally going to talk about student visas being rolled back. We've already talked about it, I think, in episode one or two. 35% cut. For us in Halifax, that worked up to 7,000 people. I'm not sure if you saw, but interestingly, of that 7,000, they cut 5,000 of them in Sydney. And actually, DAL's enrollment was going up still. Crazy enough. That being said, I saw either, I think, last night or this morning that they're adding back 5,000 people. Nova Scotia is actually only losing 2,000 students. And they're doing it in Sydney, where the housing shortage is such a problem that they had people shuttling. I'm not sure if anyone saw this, but there was a shuttle bus service set up that was shuttling people from Halifax to Sydney every day for school because they could not find residency in Cape Breton anywhere. And so they had to go all the way back and forth. So they're traveling 4 hours each way per day for class.
God.
So it actually makes sense to just cut it because they're like, this is not a thing of like, oh, the school's going to be hurting. It's like, no, this was a ridiculous problem. This was not like
an intro course in Irish poems or something.
Yeah, and you're taking an 8-hour bus ride back and forth to go to that. Imagine. Anyways, long story short, they've added a bunch of people back to that. So Nova Scotia as a whole is going to come out of it really well, I think. The capital gains tax, I had some notes on here, but the other thing on that capital gains, I should have added this in there, is 31.5 million people won't be affected by it, is their estimation. And that kind of makes sense because a good majority aren't business owners. And also a big majority aren't necessarily investment property owners. And so
I think they might
be. The idea is that they're taxing the quote unquote rich.
Yeah, but like when their family doctor leaves, they might be impacted by that.
Well, this is exactly.
Like when the company they work for decides not to expand, but rather to like get absorbed by another company in their layoffs, they might be affected by that.
Yeah.
Like,
I know.
I don't want to get on here
by the fact that there's no high paying jobs.
I don't want to get on here and preach about like trickle down economics because like
we've done that a bunch of times. We can't do it. I just got you off of this. We can't do this again.
Yeah. I'm spiraling. Right?
If you don't like it, you need to move. Okay.
I talked to Lana about it and it's not happening.
Take her to Miami next week and you guys might have a different opinion.
Yeah. I just want to run a business down there and somehow still live up here. I got to talk.
I'm doing it. I have to. 6 months of the year. You go in the winter. Nothing good here happens between October 1st to May 1st. When are we at here? It's starting to get kind of nice out now.
Yeah.
So honestly, October 1st to June 1st, really, you're not missing.
I just want to go down there, set up a bunch of laundromats.
Yeah.
And then
just count change.
Anyone who knows how to set up a business in the States, hit me up.
Okay, we're going to get into some more casual topics. I want to bring this one up because I got roasted for it when they made a reel.
You were in a reel? Someone else's?
No, it was one of ours way back.
Okay.
And I said, I was like, in Dubai, they proposed this 170 kilometer long building. Do you remember that? The mirrored like
line? Yeah, you got the country
and
wrong.
It was Saudi Arabia that
Oh, Neil.
Anyway, so bringing it back up because Saudi Arabia has scaled the project back.
Yeah, it's supposed to be how many miles?
170 kilometers.
170 kilometers? So what's that?
So like
100 miles?
Yeah, roughly. A little more. But they've, and to house 9 million people, they have now scaled it back to 2.4 kilometers.
Oh.
And they expect 300,000 people to live in it.
That's a solid downgrade.
Yeah. So they're doing about 1.5% of what they originally anticipated. Anyways, not to talk shit. This actually makes sense. This is still a massive building, a 2.5 kilometer long building. It will be very cool. But it just was kind of funny how the press release originally came out as like this building.
I remember that.
That would take 2 hours to drive along.
Oh, yeah. You did get trolled for getting the
I did.
Wrong.
I did. I remember I got roasted.
Yeah.
The next project I want to talk about that I thought was interesting because it's actually in Canada, Vancouver. They're putting in a new subway line. They're spending $2 billion doing it. It'd be sweet if we did something like that here. There's nothing there. Right now, everything's above ground for them.
Really?
And they're going to be tunneling underneath, which I thought was neat because I feel like everyone's seen it happen in Europe. And so to see it taking place in Canada, I was like, damn, Vancouver is like a pretty advanced city for us. And then here in Halifax, we have electric ferries coming, maybe.
Oh, man, that ferry's going to be a disaster.
You think?
I mean, it's going to go over budget. It's going to go over time.
Of course. Any good government contract would.
I just can imagine that thing just floating in the middle of the Bedford Basin with out of battery and just floating there and just bidding around.
Crashing into like the shoreline.
Yeah.
No. They're going to have some sort of backup in it. They got to. Paddles. Yeah. Everyone's going to have to get out and paddle.
Yeah.
It looks pretty cool. It's like this like futuristic looking glass box, rectangle.
Yeah. And it'll get downscaled just like that 90 mile building.
It'll be like an inflatable dinghy.
It's like, wow, sick Boston Whaler you got there.
People are getting water splashed on their face. Anyways, okay, moving along. I kind of bounced around here. The next thing I'm going to throw at you, Nova Scotia puts a temporary stop on the restaurant sector immigration applications due to high demand. Any concerns, thoughts there? Well, maybe I'll give some clarity first. So as many of you probably know, if you have a business, you can apply to bring people in from overseas by basically giving them a job. So you can say like, hey, I have someone over here in, we'll say India, because that's probably where a lot of them are coming from right now. And I need 5 employees. So I'm going to hire 5 people from India and you can get them all sorted out. And there's firms that will get you matched up with people and they'll bring them over to Canada. And it's been, honestly, one of the more prevalent ways that have been utilized to bring people into the country.
Yeah.
So them putting the brakes on it, to me, it was a little concerning. Your thoughts?
Well, I've heard tell that sometimes these jobs were actually not really even jobs. Like they were just a means to get to the country.
Who told you that?
By way of this. People I know. No, so like, I don't know if that's the case or not, but I,
are we taking the lid off something here right now?
No.
Are you saying these aren't real jobs?
No, but I've heard that sometimes people who use them as basically a fact track to get into a country.
Okay. You don't think we need 100,000 chefs in
Halifax? But this was the other thing I was going to say. Having said that, I don't know. Every restaurant I talk to talks about having struggles with staffing. So what is their logic for cracking down on this?
They just said the sector has seen an unprecedented surge in applications, leading to concerns about exceeding the federal allocation limits provided to the province. So their idea is that, we need to support the food and beverage sector, but we also have other labor challenges, predominantly construction, and we need to kind of focus on filling with that. So if we have space for 10,000 people to come, we can't have 9,000 of them be chefs.
Right. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, and healthcare. Healthcare and construction were the critical sectors that need to take up the space.
Gotcha. Oh, yeah. Then that makes total sense.
Do you think that's a news release, or do you think the actual reason is that some of these chefs might not just be chefs?
Well, again, this is similar to a lot of criticism about some of these students not actually taking classes. I think they are actively looking at these loopholes to try to close some of them, right? Because whether it's anecdote or I don't know any of the data on it, you want to make sure that these things are being utilized the way they're supposed to be being utilized. But I'm surprised to hear that there were so many of them because, I don't know, every restaurant I know says they can't find staff.
So you're saying that the people that they're bringing in aren't actually chefs? Because if we had this many chefs, they would have no problem.
I feel like you're putting words in my mouth right now.
Who are you talking to about this?
People in commercial real estate where I'm like, how does that restaurant survive? No one is ever in there.
But there's four BMWs in the parking lot.
No, they say like, basically they can get their workers for free or their workers pay them to come work here. That's what I've...
Okay. You heard it here first. Don't trust anything that you hear on this podcast.
And I'm not making no judgments on any of that. Like if I wanted to go to a country, I would find a way to go there.
I think we can talk about that. I mean, ultimately, neither of us own a restaurant, unfortunately, so we won't take that much heat on it. But yeah, I think it's also semi-common knowledge that people immigrate through any possible means, and restaurants have been an easy way to bring in a ton of people. And basically, like to what Chandler said, a bunch of people will buy their application. They'll buy their way to the front of the line, right? So it's like, we need 10 workers at this restaurant, and they'll be like, I'll give you whatever amount of money to become one of your workers.
Yeah, hire me.
Hire me.
Like,
and I'll come work, do whatever, but realistically, I just need to get into the country, and then I'll find another job.
Exactly. And if like I knew someone who was already in a country, and I, like literally, I just said 2 minutes ago, like if you know how to start a business in the U.S., DM me, right? And if it got me to the U.S. because someone opened a business down there, like, hey, Chandler, you want to come and work the grill for a little bit to get here? I'd be like, yeah,
unlimited SPF 100.
Yeah, get me on that grill.
And then you just be sitting there. I could see you. What's the grill master, baby? What's the
Good Burger?
Good Burger.
Yeah, welcome to Good Burger.
Welcome to Good Burger.
Keenan actually is married to a woman from Nova Scotia.
I don't remember. This isn't that. I ended Good Burger. I don't. Who's Keenan?
He's like
the main guy.
Yeah, kind of the heavyset dude. He's on SNL.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
He married a girl from Nova Scotia.
Okay. Well, those are my news articles. I wanted to throw them at you. The main idea was the tax sucks and we have way too many chefs in this country.
Apparently.
So, moving forward into something that people actually want to hear about, which is the Housing Accelerator Fund.
Yeah.
And when I say people, that means anyone who listens within this province. I don't think there's too many people that listen outside of this province. Nobody else cares about us. So you've probably, again, I think all of you have seen this because it's been so relevant in the news and like probably if you own a house within this area, you may have had someone knock on your door offering you more money than you thought it was worth or being semi-aggressive and trying to purchase your property. Or you've also seen houses go on the market and you're like, why the hell did this go for $500,000 more than it did last year? Or why the hell is this house even worth more than the house two streets in from here? They're the exact same house and arguably this is a busier, worse street. And this is probably why. The Housing Accelerator Fund is something that is going on across the country by the federal government. And because not just Nova Scotia is having a housing problem, everyone's having a housing problem. And they're basically stating that we will give is it province or municipality? It's municipality.
It's municipality.
We will give the municipality a certain amount of dollars if you guys show us that you are going to use those dollars to then increase the housing stock. And basically saying like, give out a ton of permits and show how you're upzoning the city. And so the amount of money is not small.
It's $4 billion.
$4 billion. And for Halifax, it's looking like about $100 million.
They're essentially pitting municipalities almost against each other, but in a good way. It's to incentivize them because this is a pool of money that if you don't meet these criteria, you don't get the money.
Exactly.
Right? And so the criteria in real lay terms, I just have some notes here, to remove barriers to increasing units, to accelerate growth of supply, and to show a plan, and to target an increase in growth of 10%+. So that doesn't mean 10 plus numbers, but whatever rate of growth you're growing at, you have to increase that by 10%. So however many housing starts you had last year, you have to try to increase that by 10, which is going to be very difficult in this climate. But that's in order to do these things, that's why you see the city highly motivated to, one, upzone the entire city. Because right away, the city can say, we've increased our capacity for increased units by, you know, 20% potentially if all these projects were to come to fruition. Then doing things like expediting the approval process by making all these things as of right, that shortens the wait times. All of these things the city is doing so that they can then go to the feds and say, we did our part, now give us some of that sweet, sweet money, because the municipalities desperately want that money. And other things they've done is, so they
have to use it for infrastructure, I think it is, to support the housing, do they not? Or is that just kind of what they're all assuming, that we're all assuming that they're going to do, and then they probably won't?
I'm actually not entirely sure about that. I kind of assumed it was, but now when you ask, I'm not sure exactly how they then have to allot that money. But so that's what they're trying to target, more starts in the multi-unit space, more starts in the single-family residential. But they're also hoping to remove any restrictions to increase densification. And that's why, you know, in most neighborhoods in Halifax, even in residential areas, you will be allowed to put upwards of 4 units in your existing structure, like on your lot, even though you think like, oh, I'm just in like the suburban little place, it's all single families family. No, you know, as proposed, you'll be able to have 4 units in your area.
That hasn't gone through.
Nothing's gone through yet. But the
and there
city,
was some pushback in Toronto.
Yeah, there's been pushback here. That's why they're already on the second draft. And you've seen some things go from 5 stories down to 4 stories.
Do you think it's
going to
go through the 4 units everywhere? I don't think it's going to.
You don't think so?
No. I'm less optimistic. I think, and this is why I think you're seeing
I don't think it's going to matter either way, but
here you're seeing the areas that were like originally 2 units, which have now been upzoned to 3 units. You're seeing areas like that actually get the option to do 6 units or 8 units now. And I think what they're going to try and do is eliminate the 4 unit everywhere. And then in the areas that are like low, medium density, and they're going to focus on making the medium density. When I say medium, I mean like 6 to 12 units a lot, which is currently probably a house or a duplex or maybe a triplex.
Yeah. And this idea that as long as you stay within your height and you stay within your setbacks and you stay within your lot coverage, go ham. Put as many units as you want in certain areas, as long as you meet these criteria. So either way, where exactly things land, I mean, there's going to be revisions. It was supposed to be passed by now, as you can imagine. It's not.
I think there's no way.
Best case scenario, it happens in May. Again, not super likely, which then bleeds into June. So that they actually have this thing written into law. And so what has happened, like I've got sites that went from 6 stories to 9 stories overnight. I have sites that went from 6 stories to 7 stories. And I'm not talking like, oh, you might be able to. It's like, no, that is as a right. Like if you have your drawings and it meets, you know, the allowances, you can pull a permit on that right away. There's none of this long delay.
This was my next stage. So how it's impacted people. So for you, you've gotten some upzoning.
Yeah, I got significant upzoning in some stuff.
And some people got some crazy ones. Some people had nothing. And then overnight got like massive, because you already had something and then it got better.
Yeah. And some people got like from, oh, I can do 6 to I can do like 30. You know?
There was the massive one. So again, but where it really panned out, and I think this is really important for someone listening, if you're trying to make some money right now, is main, like they're called transit corridors, the main streets. So a transit corridor is a main street that has transit on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they want to see it, because the idea is they want to be close to transit, because all these cities need to focus on getting people onto transit to keep traffic down and actually make a city sustainable. So
they also tend
to
be connecting streets. Like if you look at, you know, one that's highly contentious in Dartmouth is Victoria Road. It's like, well, Victoria Road connects downtown to an industrial park and a highway.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of a main corridor. The problem is it's heavy residential and it backs onto residential. So there's some give and take there. Windmill Road, where I've got a lot of upzoning. It's like, again, that goes from downtown to industrial. And to
Windmill's
another
a pretty
community,
more clear cut,
right? Like, so it's, you know, those are the main roads that got upzoned quite a bit.
Well, I mean, on and Dartmouth side, there is all the main arteries went crazy. Like Quinpool went psycho; they went to 40 stories, like it was nuts. But I guess, again, my point is, if you're listening and you're like, "How can I make some money?" and "How are there opportunities out there right now?" Look along these transit corridors. First of all, there's the ones that are within the zone, right? So for Halifax, they focused on within our circumferential and on the peninsula. But there is the rest of the city still.
Yeah. They're going to have to sort
those out. And there's transit in the rest of the city. And there's these main corridors in the rest of the city. Look where the main arteries are. And our city's funny because all the main arteries have single family homes on them. Doesn't matter how big the street is. It can be 6 lanes wide and they'll still be single family homes.
Heron Cove.
Portland Street.
Sackville Drive. Portland Street.
Main Street.
Yeah.
Like these all have homes on them sitting on like 6,000-7,000 square foot lots. Yep. If you can get 2 of those lots on one of those streets,
you got a little something going.
You have a little something there. A 30, a 40, a 50 unit building can probably go on those 2 lots as of current. And Right now, we're capping everything between 6 to 9 stories. Well, just before this, everything was capped at like 5 to 7. And before that, it was capped at a triplex. And they're moving it up quickly. And you're starting to see them be like, oh, okay, maybe we will do 20 stories. Maybe we will do 30. So if you're not in a major rush and you're like, maybe I want to buy a house to rent, if you can buy one on one of those main drags, rent it, and maybe in 20, 30 years, it actually can do 20 stories or 30 stories, and you have an opportunity for a huge win. But even if it doesn't go that high, at a minimum, you can probably bank on the fact that you'll get maybe 6 stories or 5 stories,
yep,
which will be a huge win. And again, the whole point of real estate is to own the land. So if you can just service the land and the debt by having a house that rents, in the future, having land along main drags will win. And again, look through Vancouver and Toronto and any of these big cities, and you drive down any main street, and all the main streets are just tower after tower after tower after tower. If you believe in the fact that Halifax's population is going to continue to grow, this would be a prime way to make some money on that. And again, it might not be overnight. You might get lucky and it might be overnight. Some of these will be. And there's a lot of that happening right now. You're seeing people have massive wins overnight. But this is the first wave. So we'll go through this wave. Maybe in 5 years, it starts to settle down. And then again, in 5 years after that, there'll be another wave. And you'll be the one sitting there owning 2-3 houses on the main drags. And you can sell them for huge numbers. Yeah. Bears Road is another prime example. Bears Road, I remember when I got my license, those houses used to go for like 150 to 210. They were kind of cleaned up and they'd be 210. And there'd even be a basement apartment in them. Now they go for 750.
Yeah.
And actually, literally up until 3 years ago, they went for 210. And now then the center plan came out.
Well, no, but
350. Still not like, yeah, okay. Yeah. So 3 years ago, 350. But then center plan came out the next day, 550.
Yeah.
And now
they got zoned even more.
And now the accelerator fund, 750. And so in 3 years, you went, and again, if you buy something that cheap, like the percentage growth is massive.
Yeah. So that's a land windfall approach. But what do you think about this idea of being able to increase density in things like single family homes? And
I don't think you should do 4 units in every house. I don't think that makes any sense. Because, I mean, there's neighborhoods. If you aspire to be in a nice suburban neighborhood, like, and then you go out and you buy a nice home that's designed to be a single family home in a suburban street, and then someone like myself comes along and just buys the one right next to you and janks in 4 shitty units.
So you're saying you wouldn't want to live beside yourself?
Yeah. Hell, not if I jam 4 units into the house.
NIMBY Neil. Now it's NIMBY Neil.
I am my own NIMBY. Yeah. I don't want to be in my own backyard, okay? That's how bad it is. No. But seriously, man. Like, I don't think you should be able to just go into any neighborhood and jam them in there. Now, the tough part becomes what neighborhoods can you do that and which ones can't? Because you're saying there's more or less value in those. Because the other thing is, if you can jam in 4 units in a house, there's a good likelihood that the house is actually worth a lot more than if you can't. But then on the flip side, there's also a portion of the market.
No.
Well, exactly. Then there's a portion of the market that respects that you can't do that and wants to be in those neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So then that pushes up the value. Long story short, I don't think it should be this blanket approach everywhere that you can do it. But I do think from the core, when they work their way out from the core, those are the neighborhoods that they do need to look at and be like, okay, we need to zone all of this, whatever we're calling it, ER3, I think is what's going to end up being. And if your lot is 5,000 square feet, you can do 10 units. And you can have a height of 4 stories. And you see this in places like Montreal again. And that, and they didn't deviate on that. They just said all the streets in the next 2 blocks and 2 blocks this way, all of them can do it. And then
so
they
do you
fully
think there's
got
a
built out.
Business model there? Like if you were a young guy full of piss and vinegar?
100%. Right? I think you need to be watching the hell out of the zoning. And I think the ER3 is going to be the next big win for people getting into it. And I think you're going to see all sorts of small houses in the... I don't know what they're going to do in Fairview. Fairview's, I honestly think, going to be the one that you're going to win on. If you don't have a huge budget, I think Fairview's...
Because lots are so big, too.
Exactly. Fairview lots are good size. That's where the win's going to be if you don't have a huge budget. If you can get into something for 700 plus on the peninsula, try and find a house on the biggest possible lot that you can find, probably like West End or somewhere in Dartmouth in like South Daly area or north-ish, if depending where in the north. And those areas, I think you'll be able to add on big extensions onto these houses.
Picture like a Fairview lot. You know, when they have those bungalows, you subdivide. You have 2 lots and you do tiny little like 4 units on each. That'd be sick.
And then, and right now they're actually kind of being logical. So you can be like, instead of 2 4 units, can I just build 1 8 unit? And they're like, yeah, sure. And so those are reasonable. Mm. And if you do it yourself, they're stick frame. You can get them done for fairly cheap. Not super cheap, but cheap if you're involved.
But that's new construction. What about conversions?
Conversions? I'm also saying to everyone, conversions still make sense if you can get the house for the right price. And you jam in like a unit on every single floor. I just sold one and a bunch of people were like, they overpaid. Not overpaid, but they paid retail. And I was like, no, realistically, they didn't. It's a 4-story house and they could easily put like a two or a three, like it needs to put a three bedroom on each floor. And I'm like, and it's in a great location. I'm like, if you put a three bedroom on each one of these floors, this place is worth $2 million all day.
Yeah. The thing I'm getting jammed up because I'm helping a client go through a conversion right now. And I'm kind of like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this?
Is conversion or a subdivision?
Well, that's a subdivision. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Because if you're adding, if you're not developing. He's not really developing. That's just a subdividing of a current existing unit.
True.
Units.
When but
you're
that's developing, in some units, respects, you make money. Easier.
It is. But when you do development, that's where you make your money because you're like, okay, I got to spend $100K into this house to build this unit, but it's worth $250K. So you make $150K every time you build that in, right? So if you can say, okay, I get the house, I get to keep that unit, like that's development is where the money is made ultimately. So I think that play.
Increasing unit counts.
Exactly. Yeah, increasing unit counts. So I think if you can find the biggest, baddest house you can get on the biggest lot possible.
Just chop that sucker
up. And chop it up. That's a great play. But I do think ultimately they've really turned the dials that new construction makes the most sense. So, but again, and the other thing is, if you look at it, Fairview's a prime example. On Main Ave, if you can buy a house.
You're talking about like the mid-scale stick
Maybe you do the three units in the house.
Yeah.
And then all you need to do is do a little attachment to it. And then you can build another triplex in the backyard.
Yeah.
But it's one building. So it's a six unit. Right, and just attached by a little tunnel, like just to like meet the requirements. And you see this, and
why a tunnel?
Well, like I don't know, a little pathway, because you don't have to rip the whole back of the house off.
So it's just a tunnel,
a little tunnel underground. Yeah. But the you see this in some of the old houses that are around, like on Caledonia Road. There's one that's so
prime to
me.
It's got the apartment building attached to it.
There's a house in the front of the street.
Yeah,
and then there's a little tunnel. Yeah. Fuck everybody, and then there's like a 12 unit building.
It's a breezeway. The tunnel is underground. Breezeway.
Whatever. Anyways, there is a breezeway, and then there's like a 12 unit building attached to it in the back.
I've been in that building before.
Have you?
Yes. Well, not say what. No, just kidding. I was looking to sell it. And I was like, this is a weird place.
Yeah. It is a funky place. But like ultimately.
There's like, one like that in the West End too. Like this guy had. Actually, there's one up on like Windsor by Rush Hour Pizza. If you go kind of down one of those streets, there's like a house and like an apartment building attached to it.
Yeah. Because and then so these zoning laws are kind of making that make sense again. Yeah. So I don't know. I think there's still opportunities out there, even within the city, if you're willing to get creative and funky. I think it's totally viable. On the flip side, even multi-unit buildings. Like I'm looking at one of mine and I'm like, I'm pretty sure based on what's going on now, I could build another sixplex attached to this. I would do a tunnel. I don't care what anyone says. The breezeway is kind of lame. So I'd probably go underground, but the...
Subterraneous Neil.
The land is big enough that that's another option.
Yeah.
So anyways, long story short, I think the Housing Accelerator Fund is something extremely important. We think that, and you should definitely read up on it and pay attention to it. Because it could give you an opportunity to get in the marketplace.
It's also, we actually, when we spoke to St. Mary's, they're like, what was one of the things you would do? I'm like, man, I'd become an expert on these zoning things and try to find these deals and bring them to people.
And now it's exactly, even if you don't have the money to buy it, find a good deal and flip it to somebody.
Yeah.
What is the area around Maynard Lake called in Dartmouth?
I mean, it's a pretty big lake, but like that's kind of Southdale.
Yeah, like that area. I'm not sure if anyone looked at the map, but that whole thing is ER3. And those houses sit on nice sized lots.
Yeah,
and those are hilly. Nice streets.
Really hilly, but yeah.
It is hilly. But I mean, once you just chop around the top, who cares? You're not walking up the hill with your 2x4s.
Yeah. Like, but I mean, for like for sewer, water and sewer, it's tricky.
Oh, yeah. But again, if you get a house for $500,000, you can put an 8-plex there.
Yeah.
And you got to pay an extra $10,000 for water and sewer. Like
you mean south of, like below Maynard Lake. Because above Maynard Lake.
That all went ER3.
That's more like Manor Park.
Manor Park. See, that's what I was asking. I don't know the names very well, but so like Manor Park. Look, there's one up right now. $399, 8,400 square foot lot. And I'm pretty sure 8,000 square foot lots. They're talking at one sec. It's ER2 now, but I'm pretty sure they're proposing ER3 on that street. And 8,400 square foot lot, I believe, was 8 or 12 units is what they're saying. And I think that'll actually go through. And so something like this, you put your 5% down and off you go. Now, it's not going to go for $400. It'll probably go for like, my guess is $456, $250. Yeah. But like, still, if you can get something for $457,000 and you can build a tunnel. There's already a tunnel. Look, the garage is already underground. So you just put the building on the front and attach it and off you go.
There you go. Well, there's some reason for optimism after my boohoo start for the first 20 minutes of the episode.
Yeah, Jesus, man. Worse than me.
But it still gets into this idea of like, you know, having to build new construction. And man, that's tricky right now. It's really hard. But
it's nerve-wracking.
Do you remember a long time ago? I can't remember if we talked about this on air or if we talked about this, you and I, like the downtown projects are sexy. Right. And like these, you know, six story to 30 story, that's super sexy.
Yeah.
But there's something to be said to going out of town and doing above grade, like on grade parking, like no underground parking, just a paving the asphalt, slapping up like the most economical three level 12 unit building and just knocking those suckers out stick frame because you can get a house builder to build it. You don't need concrete form people. Like you don't need to dig down.
When you're starting out, you have to do that.
totally. But like, it also, it's just not exciting and cool. But man, like, there's something to it, because I think that's a replicable model. Because you could literally downtown, you have to build so specific to every site.
It's so expensive when you go out a little bit, foot.
Man. Like, what worked with those? We've all seen these cul-de-sacs. You own a cul-de-sac of these, yeah, where it's just six units as far as the eye can see, yeah, one after another. Can, yeah, you imagine how easy those would have been to build back in the day?
That's, man, too, because they just like, you just, the trades literally just do it here, and then the next week they start on the next, yeah, one, and the next one, and the next one. Like, the efficiencies are unbelievable. Yeah. But,
and those are all in areas that used to be a little bit out of town. And this is why I think people went out your way towards Enfield and all this stuff and all that. And I think they kind of quickly met a point of saturation. But like, there's a good model to build those units out. It's just not as sexy as downtown. And
if you, yeah, want to be super forward thinking, go to communities, find big parcels of land or buildings with, or houses sitting on bigger pieces, go and talk to their planners and suggest to them that, okay, look, I'm going to buy this house, like in Truro, I'm going to buy this house on the main drag. It's got a 20,000 square foot lot. If you guys give me 15 stories, you're going to get 150 grand from the Housing Accelerator Fund.
Yeah.
Like, and so yeah, they'll be like, hell yeah, we'll give you the permit.
Yeah.
And they'll get 150 grand for doing it. And now you have the permit for this. You might not be able to build it, but you can flip it off. There's ways to make money out there right now. Yeah. I'm just, when, now keep in mind, once you make the money, then you have to cut pretty much all of it back.
Yeah,
to the
then
government.
You make none of the money.
But there's good ways to make the Canadian government a bunch of money right now.
Yeah, there's good ways. To pay for,
they're actually getting, they here. Actually get back, like the Housing Accelerator from the $4 billion, it insta recycles in this whole process for them.
So, man, we're all right, we'll talk about that another day. We're gonna, yeah, talk about, yeah, that, another day. But like, this is the model, right? Like, you can print money because, like, even if you take on big deficits, like, all the inflation means the deficit isn't actually worth as much as it once was, and it's no big deal because then you just tax all the money right back, huh? You give it away. And then you tax it right back. And so they're like, they kind of don't care.
Kind of,
right?
Slick.
It's kind of slick, he says.
How can you replicate that model but own the business?
Yeah.
What business can create that?
Government. That's it.
Buy an island. Start your own country. All right.
Yeah, let's wrap up there.
Thanks for listening. Peace.
Thanks so much for watching the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, press like. Don't forget to subscribe. But also check us out on Instagram and TikTok. You can find all the links below. Thanks again for checking us out. When I was broke, I had rich habits. When I was broke, I had rich habits.